Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 91, recorded Saturday, June 18th, 2011. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this special customer services edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: can't patch planes forever, and winning customers with a personal touch. So this week, I've actually been in town more than not since the last episode. Both my kids had graduations, my son from high school, my daughter from middle school. I decided it would be a good thing to be around for those. Of course, you know, nothing comes for free, so my packed travel schedule in May was sort of paying forward for the 2 weeks off the road in the beginning of June. And then I was back at it last week, back down to Phoenix for triple-digit highs, 105 degrees every afternoon. Yes, I know that it's a dry heat, but then again, so's an oven. Then out to London for a customer meeting out tomorrow night, Sunday night. I hate flying Sunday nights. They just, like, blow your entire weekend. Back Tuesday afternoon, but instead of heading home, I just get on a little tram at O'Hare, go back over to the domestic terminal, and pick up a flight down to Austin, Texas for the last 2 days of a travel technology conference, then home, then back to the UK, but this time at least combining some leisure with business. We fly from Chicago to Manchester on an American 757, which I have to say I'm dreading. Head over for an afternoon to my dad's hometown of Southport, which is a little town on the Irish Sea, kind of halfway between Liverpool and Blackpool. Then up to the Lake District for a couple of days of hiking, drive around the west coast of Scotland for a couple of days, head over to Edinburgh for a couple of days, take the train down to London, and then while I work in London for the next few days, my family just sort of sightsees around. Looking at my TripIt page, I see no other travel planned. An oversight that I'm sure will be fixed soon. Following up, Robert Fennerty left a good suggestion at the Travel Commons website on the Table for One Eating Alone blog post. Robert writes, "When I'm on the road, I seek out live jazz. I can sit at a table for 90 minutes, order food and wine, and relax. In Chicago, I visit Bandera, where the servers don't hover and the private little booths reduce the look at that guy factor to a bare minimum. In Europe, jazz is easier to find than most U.S. cities, but if you find the hip part of town, you can usually find jazz. But don't ask your concierge for jazz because they don't know what jazz is." Hey, Robert, that is a great suggestion. Find a live music club, linger, and enjoy yourself. Because really, how often do you get to do that at home? I mean, especially if you've got kids. I always enjoy taking out-of-town guests to blues clubs in Chicago. My favorite is Blues. Kind of, it's spelled out B period L period U period E period S. It's a small place on the north side of Chicago in Lincoln Park. On the weekends, the place is packed. But on the weekdays, you can sit at the bar. You can, you know, have a couple of beers without being jammed. Hell, sometimes you end up having beers with the band when they're on break, and you really get to sort of enjoy the music without the scrum of the weekend crowds. And I guess that's the other great thing about Robert's suggestion. You're going to the week, no crowds to get between you and appreciating the music. It's a great idea. Steve Sektig, a longtime Travel Commons listener, posted this suggestion after last month's episode. Steve writes, "Love the post, and especially the idea of bringing a small power strip plus a voltage adapter for devices. That's clever. I'd throw one more thing there that is a benefit to Apple. The interchangeable external power adapter allows me to plug my MacBook into EU, UK, and Australian power outlets. Those are the ones I've tested so far. And I have a micro 4-port USB adapter that I plug into the laptop, effectively giving me charging for the mobile, the iPad, yes, I still travel with both, and the headset. Just a thought, as the USB adapter is probably 4 inches by a half inch by a quarter inch, very small. The only other comment I'd make then about US Air, right, Steve? Are you crazy? Steve, I actually like the idea of the 4-port USB hub for charging. I've been looking for a power strip that has both outlets and USB ports, but have yet to find one. Now, Steve's solution sounds more compact than mine. I'll tell you, the only reason I might stay with a power strip is that 220-volt play. I mean, everything just seems to charge like on warp speed when you move from the 110 volts here in the U.S. to the 220 volts overseas. And U.S. Air? Yeah, Steve, you know, I mean, that was just a momentary lapse of judgment. It'll never happen again. My sympathies to listeners in Charlotte, Pittsburgh, and Philadelphia and Phoenix. You know, and on a complete sidetrack, speaking of power strips, I have to tell you that I was hugely impressed during last month's Google I.O. conference in San Francisco's Moscone Center. Literally every third seat had a power strip zip-tied to the chair leg. I mean, talk about customer service. Talk about catering to your audience's most primal needs. However, I do think I've just about hit the limit on my electronic gadgets. On my trip to Phoenix this past week, I brought all my portable gadgets, my iPhone 4, my iPad 2, my Motorola Droid 2, my new Samsung Galaxy Tab 10.1 running Android 3.1. It's a cornucopia of numbers here. Well, anyhow, I brought them all because I needed to load our new mobile application for booth demos at the trade show. So along with my MacBook Air, my Motorola wireless Bluetooth headphones, you know, not a cell phone headphone, but literally kind of iPod headphones that I use for my morning workouts, and then my Jabra, you know, Bluetooth mobile phone headset. I don't know. I just felt like I spent all my time charging devices. My power strip in my office was completely full all the time, as was the travel power strip and most of the outlets in my hotel room. You know, I kind of felt like the gadget version of Mr. Creosote for Monty Python and the Meaning of Life. You know, one more gadget, just a small wafer of a device, and I'll take down the whole power grid for Arizona. Okay, God only knows that there is no love lost between me and the TSA, and I make no bones about it on this podcast. And for their part, the TSA usually does a great job of providing fodder for my mill. Last month's YouTube video of a TSA agent patting down an infant was only the latest in a long line of head shakers. However, to give credit where credit is due, many TSA agents are thoughtful, pragmatic people. They're not on a power trip, and they're just trying to get to the other end of the day while keeping some sort of grip on their job, their paycheck, and their sanity. And I'll tell you, I saw a couple of these sorts of guys in O'Hare 2 weeks ago when I was having to make an overnight trip to Dallas. I mean, the X-ray reader saw something odd, so one of the screeners did a manual search of this guy's bag, guy in front of me in line. The screener pulls out an 18-inch long, 1-inch diameter metal rod wrapped in brown paper. The screener says, "I'm sorry, but you can't carry this on. It can be used as a weapon." And then, you know, gives it a swing, you know, kind of like a baseball bat, as if to punctuate what was a completely obvious choice to the rest of us in line. I mean, remember, we're in the status line. It's the frequent traveler line. The guy who owned the rod looks surprised. I mean, and the rest of them are looking at him like, really? I mean, this thing is 100 times more dangerous than a police baton. What the hell were you thinking trying to check this thing on? The screener, for his part, calmly and professionally explained that he could either go back out and check his bag or leave his 5-pound metal baton behind. He left it behind. I mean, two of the screeners swung it a couple of times and said the same thing those of us in line did. "You really thought you could carry this on? I mean, really?" Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of the Oklahoma guy arrested at O'Hare earlier last month for trying to carry on a loaded gun. I mean, you know, he said he thought he needed it for self-defense in Chicago. I mean, again, really? Come on. I mean, reading stories like these reminds me, I guess, to be a bit more patient with the TSA guy at the front who's telling or yelling at everyone to empty their pockets before going through the metal detector. I mean, you know, in spite of 10 years of going through this drill, I guess there are just still some clueless travelers out there who either, you know, don't think the rules apply to them or just don't think, period. Hey, if you've got a question, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address is comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. You can use the voice memo app on your iPhone or something like virtual recorder on your Android phone to record and send in an auto comment. You can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, or you can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or you can always sort of go old school, Bob Frenerty and Steve Sechtig did, and post your thoughts on the website at travelcommons.com. The first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is Can't Patch Planes Forever. In the last episode, I talked about the difference in the business class experience between airlines, that the commodity view of air travel, a seat on one plane flying from point A to point B is the same, is interchangeable with any other airline flying on that route. I mean, that view is just wrong. There are real differences between airline services. I mean, the question is really how much you're willing to pay. While taxiing out of Madrid Airport last month, I saw three Ryanair planes at adjacent gates. Ryanair, whenever I see those planes, it just always makes me shake my head. I mean, what person places such a low value on their time and just sort of general well-being and self-esteem that they're willing to put up with an airline that I think really makes it clear how little they think of their customers. I mean, Spirit Airlines in the U.S. strikes me the same way. I mean, we'll give you lower prices, but you'll pay for it financially and psychically in so many other ways. I mean, obviously, a lot of people are willing to accept a lot for a low price ticket, or a lot of people just don't know how to calculate the full cost of their experience. While taking yet another maintenance delay on an American Airlines MD-80 last month, I mean, this drove the point home to me again. I'll tell you, 5 to 7 years ago, I can't remember the exact time frame, when many of the U.S. airlines were declaring bankruptcy to clean up their balance sheets, I mean, United, Continental, Northwest, American was proud that it stayed out of Chapter 11 and didn't wipe out its stockholders, many of which, of course, were the executive management team. That had a price, though. So to conserve cash, they delayed buying new planes. I mean, you know, a new Boeing 737 can run anywhere from $50 to $70 million, depending on your negotiating skills. But today, that airline is now still flying planes from the mid to late 80s. I mean, that's when I first started flying America. I mean, when you're boarding one of those MD-80s, look on the left-hand side of sort of the door frame as you walk in. There's a small metal plate, and on it is stamped the date the plane was manufactured. I mean, I look at it every time. I see a lot of 1988s, 89s, 92s. And not much after that. So here we are in 2011. I mean, is it any wonder I'm seeing a lot of maintenance delays? I mean, flipping through my calendar, 75% of my recent flights on American MD-80s have been delayed. Flights on their new 737-800s have been fine. I mean, just the record on those old MD-80s has been horrid. Last month's flight from O'Hare to Fort Myers, Florida is a typical example. They board the plane, departure time approaches, and it's eerily quiet. I mean, none of the "please take your seats, we need to leave" yelling and screaming from the flight attendants. Then the captain keys his mic. I mean, I know what he's going to say before he says it. "Hey, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We saw something on the pre-flight walk around and are having maintenance come out to look at it." I mean, this is an instant 30-minute delay, probably longer, with a 50% chance of them taking the plane out of service. Now, mind you, this was a 7:25 a.m. flight. The plane had been sitting at the gate for a while. It didn't just arrive. So why is maintenance only now just coming out at departure time? I mean, why didn't somebody do the walk around earlier? I mean, with these old MD-80s, you'd think you'd want to get a jump on it. This time, the delay was an hour and 15 minutes, which is right That's about the time, about the average time I've been experiencing. I mean, some have been shorter, when they just need to sort of reboot the airplane. Some have been longer, when they need to go back to the hangar and find another plane. But this flight, I'll tell you, this flight was kind of a tipping point for me. After this flight, I started paying attention to equipment on American flights. Every American MD-80 flight I looked at, I add in an hour to the flight time. I mean, if American isn't going to do something about their MD-80 delays, like, do some preventative maintenance, then I'll do something myself, like manually adjusting their flight times to factor in expected maintenance delays. I mean, doing this, the American MD-80 flights start to look like connecting flights. They take a lot longer than competitors' flights, and there's more risk. I mean, cancellations from mechanicals look the same as missing a connection. As I've said in past episodes, I've done sort of the rough calculus on the value of my time, and I'm willing to pay, sort of $200 more for a direct flight to avoid the risk of missing a connection. I'm now sort of at the same place with American MD-80 flights. I mean, it makes sense to pay $200 more for a flight that I have more confidence will get me where I need to be on time. Indeed, I did that, just for when I was booking next week's flight for Austin, Texas. I paid $150 more to fly back to Chicago on United rather than on an American MD-80. Now, look, I'm not arguing about the need to fix planes before flying. I mean, like every other passenger, I want to get to my destination safely, but I also want to get there on time. I mean, I do a lot of flying. The cumulative amount of time spent waiting for American to fix their old planes, look, that's a big chunk of my life that I'm never going to get back. Second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is winning customers with a personal touch. On my prior trip to Phoenix in May, when the highs were only 90 degrees Fahrenheit, I had a lousy rental return experience with Avis. I mean, parking the car in the return lot, I counted 20 people waiting to get checked in and two Avis check-in people. I just didn't have that much time to wait, especially with how far away Phoenix Airport has put that consolidated car rental facility. So I left the keys in the car and headed for the bus. I mean, I like the way Avis immediately sends an electronic receipt, so I knew I wasn't missing much except the wait and a small chat with the check-in person. So I'm in the terminal, sort of wolfing down a salad before my flight. The electronic receipt hits my iPhone. I look at it between bites, quickly glanced at it, and then looked at it much harder. The Avis employee who checked in my rental marked the fuel as empty, even though I'd filled it up on the way to the airport, and that thing, that gas gauge was solidly on full, on F. I immediately called the number on the receipt and was routed to some customer service agent somewhere who said I needed to fax them the gas pump receipt. Well, that's kind of tough to do in Phoenix Airport and Sky Harbor Terminal 3, so I told him that I'd have it done the following Monday. I did that. Time passed. I heard nothing from Avis, except an email, kind of some standard email asking me to click through to a survey about my last rental. Well, how timely. Now, normally I ignore these requests because I get a lot of them, and they usually take, way too long because they ask way too many questions. But this one, now I was more than willing to invest some time. As you might guess, my scores tended to be on the low side. Ask for specifics. I wrote that there was an empty Coke can in the car when I picked it up, and that they had charged me to refill a completely full tank. I have to tell you that I was surprised, though, when a couple of weeks later I received an email from Michael Wu, whose email signature said he was the production manager for Avis at Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. I mean, it was a very nice personal note, not some rote thing. I mean, he is, but he wrote thanking me for filling out the survey, he said, "I sincerely apologize for the inside of the vehicle being dirty with a Coke can in the back seat, and that this was left unnoticed and not cleaned correctly before your rental. I will be following this matter up with the agent who cleaned the vehicle and the driver that is responsible for parking the vehicle on the ready line. I also want to apologize for the vehicles and not the vehicles not living up to your expectations." Hey, not bad. I appreciate that. It was a nice note. It was specific. It acknowledged the problem. It apologized, and it said he was going to take corrective action. What more can you ask? So I wrote him a reply. I said, "Look, I got to tell you that the empty Coke can in the back seat wasn't the worst part of my rental experience. It was the car return." And then I went on to describe the incorrect fuel charge and lack of any remedial action. The result I ended my note with is that Avis made an unearned $12.99 in fuel charge on this rental, but has lost my business going forward. I'm currently in Southwest Florida driving a Hertz rental car and will be back in Phoenix in mid-June and have reserved a Hertz car for that trip rather than an Avis car. I admit that it felt good to send this note to a real person, not just a "do you have anything else to tell us" comment box on a web survey. Mr. Wu didn't let me down. 2 days later, he came back with this follow-up. "I'm truly sorry," he wrote, "that you were put in such a bad situation and went through all the trouble trying to get this resolved without any resolution or follow-up. I will personally adjust the fuel charge and a little extra for all the inconvenience. I will also forward this to proper management so that they are aware about issues and returns and the follow-up. I would also like to extend to you a personal offer for the next time you happen to rent from Avis. You just need to email me your reservation number for Avis, and I'll personally make sure your vehicle is clean, Coke can free, and ready for you. I'd also add a free upgrade and money off coupons for your trouble. Once again, I sincerely apologize and hope for the opportunity to better serve your car rental needs in the near future." And the following week, the credit showed up on my Amex. Now I have to rent from Avis the next time I'm in Phoenix. I mean, Mr. Wu goes out of his way to fix the problem, follows up twice, and offers to take care of my next rental personally. I mean, I've always said that at its core, the travel experience is a person-to-person one. No matter how much cost-cutting technology companies put in the middle, kiosks, mobile check-ins, and by the way, I'm not complaining about those. I really like them. When I want a quick transaction, it's great. But the moments that we remember and that stay with us are not how well the touchscreen worked, but was how well we were treated by other people. A flight attendant with a snarky retort to your question, or a gate agent who went out of her way to rebook you off a canceled flight. I mean, these are what we remember. And that's the reason I've got to rent my next car from Mr. Wu, who just happens to work for Avis. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons Podcast number 91. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast and hope you decide to stay subscribed. This episode's bridge music is for me, courtesy of the GarageBand app on my iPad 2. I don't think Trent Reznor has anything to worry about, but it did keep me occupied on a few of those MD-80 delays. So hey, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com, or to M. Peacock on Twitter, or write them on the Travel Commons wall on Facebook, or post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, and post comments on the various locations. I'm kind of tying this off now. I'm going to end up probably editing this on my flight over to London Sunday night / Monday morning. So not quite sure when this will get up. Using a new editing rig. Adobe Audition, actually on the Mac. So we'll see how this works. Otherwise, you'll see it toward the end of the week. Take care, and until we talk again, thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
Home alone, life is hell. Strange bed in a lonely thing and ease my mind. The warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing fine.